Thank you. So what I'm going to talk about today is based on some work that I've been doing in collaboration with Alberto, Bart Horn, who is also at Columbia, and Steve Gabser at Princeton. And I should say that this is still work in progress, but we're very excited about the direction in which this is going. So we thought we would like to just share with you what we've learned so far and some of our results. I should also add that the idea of applying effective theory techniques to study vortex lines and their coupling to sound was initiated by Solomon and by Alberto. And so in this sense, what I'm going to talk about really was inspired by their work and really builds on that. Now, the advantage of giving a talk after Russell and Carlo and William already did is that by now probably I don't need to convince you that vortex lines and vortex rings are very fascinating objects. The slight disadvantage is that they already showed all the cool videos that I wanted to show you, but that's okay, we'll have to deal with that. So as we've seen, vortex lines are configurations that are solutions of hydrodynamic equations that exist in fluids and in superfluids as well. And in particular, in superfluids, they have a quantum origin and are in fact the only vorticles configurations that are allowed by the system. And the reason why they're particularly interesting is because despite the appearance, so we have these one-dimensional objects, in fact, they don't behave like relativistic strings nor like material strings. So this is a video by the same collaboration that produced the video that Carlo showed yesterday. So here we see some vortex line in superfluid helium. The reason why we can see them is because they injected some hydrogen in the superfluid helium, and the hydrogen floats, as William explained very well this morning, floats to the core of the vortex line due to the gradient pressures. So let me show you one more time, just to point out that there are many things going on here. For instance, these vortices, when they collide, they reconnect. And often, when they collide, in fact, usually, these excitations are produced that propagate along the vortex line. So these kind of excitations are known as Kelvin waves, and I'm going to have much more to say about that later in the talk. But now, before we jump in, into an effective theory kind of framework, let me just start by reviewing the basic quantities, the basic scales in the problem. So the main quantity that characterizes a vortex line is this the circulation that is called gamma. And vortex lines are really a placeholder for locations where the curl of the velocity is non-zero. Now, this gamma essentially describes the strength, if you want, of the vortex, and it controls how the velocity profile decays as you go away from the vortex line. So it decays in a 1 over r fashion, and the coefficient in front is precisely the circulation. Now, before I go on, I should also tell you that throughout this talk, I'm using units such that 4 pi is equal 1. By that, I mean that I'm going to freely omit or include the factors of 4 pi, which, of course, can be very important for experiments, but they won't play any relevant role for what I want to tell you about today. Now, when it comes to length scales, there are mainly 2 length scales that characterize a vortex line. Its thickness, which I'm going to call A, and the length scale over which the shape of the vortex line varies appreciably, this R. And the kind of effective theory that we're after is a theory that is valid at length scale much larger than thickness A, but not that large that I can no longer resolve the spatial variation of the shape of the vortex line. And similarly, this effective theory will be valid at time scales that must be much larger than the thickness divided by the speed of sound. Now, when it comes to velocities, there are mainly 2 velocities that come into play. The first one is the velocity of the vortex line itself. And the second one is the speed of sound in the bulk, on the superfluid. And in principle, you could think that we can choose these two velocities the way we want, especially the velocity v of the vortex line. But in fact, it turns out that in order to remain within the regime of validity of the effective theory, the velocity of the vortex line must be much smaller than the speed of sound. And that's because, as William explained earlier, the reason why this vortex line moves in the first place is because it's dragged by the velocity fields that it produces. And this means that its velocity is in general of the order of the circulation divided by the length scale R that characterizes its shape, the typical length scale. And within this regime, this quantity must be much smaller than gamma over A, which, if you want, describes the velocity of the superfluid in a region surrounding the core of the vortex line. And now, by demanding that this velocity never becomes larger than the speed of sound, we find that V indeed must be much, much smaller than the speed of sound. Now, as I said at the beginning, vortex lines exist both in fluids and in superfluids. So if we try to come up with an effective theory description for vortex lines, there are in principle two approaches that we can follow. The first one is start from an effective theory for fluids, which describes both compressional and rotational degrees of freedom, and assume that the vorticose motion in this fluid, so that we restrict basically ourselves to configurations such that the vorticose motion is only due to vortex lines. Okay, and this is essentially the approach that Solomon and Alberto followed, but it's not the approach that I would like to follow today. Today we're gonna instead start from superfluids, from an effective action for superfluids, which, as probably most of you know, only describes compressional degrees of freedom. And then we're gonna add vortex lines as external sources to this theory. Now, intuitively, we expect that these two approaches will actually at the end give the same result. And in fact, some of the results that we present today go in the direction of validating this guess. However, I should say that we actually don't have an airtight proof that these two approaches are exactly equivalent. And that is part of why we started, if you want, this following this approach in the first place. So before we keep going, let me just review very quickly how we describe superfluids using effective theories, although probably most of you are familiar with this. So the operational definition of a superfluid is that it's a medium in which we have a spontaneously broken U1 charge, which is at finite density. And such a medium can be described using a single scalar field whose action is invariant under internal shifts, and such that the scalar acquires this time-dependent VEV. And fluctuations around this VEV that I'm denoting with curly phi are essentially described phonons. Now, the Lagrangian in general is an arbitrary function of d mu phi. And if you're interested in now describing interactions between phonons and their dynamics, all we need to do is expand x around -1, and then expand this function f of x around x equal -1. Now, the reason why this formalism, one of the reasons why this formalism is very convenient, it's because it makes it very simple to take the non-relativistic limit, and if we want, also to take the incompressible limit. So to take the non-relativistic limit, all we need to do is just neglect this phi dot squared in x compared to the phi dot. Whereas to take the incompressible limit, which means the limit in which the speed of sound goes to infinity, what we want to do is notice that, so in front of this scale, in front of this t, in principle, there should be a scale that I set to 1 for simplicity. But that scale is really the chemical potential for the charge at finite density. And if we demand that the speed of sound remains smaller than the speed of light over a sufficiently large range of values of the chemical potential, then we can derive the fact that these coefficients in Taylor expansion must in fact scale like the speed of sound in this form, meaning higher and higher coefficients are suppressed by higher and higher powers of the speed of sound. Now, In the non-relativistic limit, it's easy to show that the velocity of the superfluid is actually just given by the gradient of the phonon field, which shows, as we know, that in fact the velocity field is the curl of the velocity field in a superfluid vanishes. Now, if we now want to introduce vortex lines, the easiest way to do it is to start in the incompressible limit. So in this case, the dynamics of vortex lines becomes particularly simple. So what I'm going to do is first consider the incompressible limit, the limit of infinite spin of sound. And once we build some intuition about how vortex lines work, we're going to move on and consider a relativistic limit in which also phonons are, the relativistic case in which also phonons are included. So as I said, what we want to do is take the incompressible and non-relativistic limit, meaning that now, in particular, in the incompressible limit, all these higher order terms become just negligible. And we're going to focus on the first term, which happens to be just at most quadratic in pi, in phi, in the phonon field. And what we're going to do is introduce some external sources by shifting the gradient of the phonon field. And this kind of shift essentially redefines the velocity in the superfluid. And I'm going to choose this external source S in such a way that its curl gives me precisely the curl of the velocity that I would like to have. And once we have done this, we can notice that we can integrate out the phonon field because, as I said, now if we forget about these terms, the action is at most quadratic. And so we can do that exactly. And what we end up with is an action like this. Yes? Yeah, I think that's yeah. So exactly, that's another way to see it. Exactly. So the kind of action that we get in the incompressible limit looks like this, and there are a few things that I would like to point out. So the first one is that this action is actually invariant under a time-dependent reparametrization of the length element of the line element. As we can see, it has it is non-local, but that of course shouldn't come as a surprise for two reasons. First one is that we introduce couplings to the vortex line in a non-local way to begin with, and the second one is that we integrated out the phonon field that is massless, and therefore there is no surprise that we end up with a non-local action.
So the non-locality is instantaneous because the speed is infinite.
Exactly, very good. Yes, because we sent speed of sound and the speed of light, and so we are not left, we don't have any other speed at which the interaction could propagate. The other thing that I would like to point out is that the kinetic term is a bit particular in the sense that it's linear, it has only one time derivative, which means that now if I derive the equations of motion starting from this action, what I end up with are first order equations of motion. So this means that for vortex lines, there is no, we're not free to impose an initial condition for the velocity of vortex lines. And the motion of vortex lines is completely determined by their shape. Okay, once I draw a line, I let it go, the vortex line will just move, carried by its own velocity field. And in this sense, there is no way in which we can talk about forces acting on this vortex line. So we cannot go there and push them and see what happens. So this is the first, if you want, counterintuitive aspect about vortex lines. Yes?
What happens, I can imagine that there's elements of the vortex line which are far away, the velocity is fine, but it will come closer and closer to the given point, how you regularize.
So that's an excellent question. As we will see, when we do calculation using this kind of action, we're going to have lots of logarithmic divergences that pop up. And part of what I'm going to say is also, what I'm going to show is how we can deal with these logarithmic divergences. All right, so now that we have this effective action, what can we do? Well, the first and easiest thing that we can do is go and try to derive the spectrum of those excitations that I showed you in the first video, so the spectrum of Kelvin waves. And to do that, we can choose a configuration where the vortex line is exactly straight, let's say aligned with the z direction. And we can fix the parametrization along the line such that sigma is equal to z. And let me call the fluctuations around this straight vortex configuration pi perpendicular. So we plug this into the action, expand up to quadratic order, and what we find for these modes is a dispersion relation of these four, okay? So notice two things. The first one is that this logarithm, so there is this funny logarithm that appears in the dispersion relation, and it really follows from the fact that when we expand the denominator here in powers of pi, the coefficient in front of the gradient term is logarithmically divergent. And so to get this kind of dispersion relation, what I really did was just I cut off the integral with a cutoff of the order of the width of the vortex line. The second thing I would like to point out is that we have we have two kinds of modes, they can, in the sense that they can propagate upward or downward, but regardless of the direction of propagation, they always rotate in the same direction, okay? And this follows from the fact that we really have, the vorticity, if you want, is picking a preferred direction of rotation around the vortex line. Very good. So the next thing that we can learn by working in the incompressible limit is that we can introduce an auxiliary field A that was dubbed hydrophoton by Solomon and Alberto. And introducing this field, what we do is we can turn this action into a local form. Now, in a sense, this is not a very profound statement because we know that one over R interactions can be mediated by a massless field, so no surprise there. But there are a few reasons why it's interesting and useful to introduce this field. So the first one is that it makes the symmetries of the action more manifest. And by that, I mean that the coefficient in front of the kinetic term and the coefficient in front of the interaction between A and the vortex line are actually the same, not because of a tuning, but because this structure is enforced by Galilean symmetry, okay? And this was something that was very difficult to see if we hadn't introduced the hydrophoton. The second reason why it's useful and interesting to introduce the hydrophoton, it's because it makes very manifest the analogy between vortex lines, the motion of vortex lines in the incompressible limit, and magnetostatic. And by that I mean that the hydrophoton couples to the vortex line really like the vector potential in magnetostatic couples to lines of current in the Coulomb gauge. So if we take the action that I showed you before and we vary with respect to A, in fact the equation of motion that we get looks like this. And notice that the right-hand side is really the vorticity, which is nothing but just the curl of the velocity. So because of that, we see that the vorticity really is analogous to the current in magnetostatic. The hydrophoton, as I said, is analogous to the vector potential. And the magnetic field is in magnetostatic is just the analogous of the velocity field.
No.
No?
The stream function is just the two dimensions of the gradient of the velocity. The velocity is the gradient of the stream function.
No, I think that's called the velocity potential. There's also a stream function which whose velocity gives you more distance. Anyway.
Okay, so you should tell me probably because it looks like you know the stream function better than I do. No, it's possible. Yeah, we should talk about that. Yes?
Something odd about the table is the parity mismatch. So current is a vector, vorticity is a pseudo vector, magnetic field is a pseudo vector, velocity is a vector. What's behind that?
Yeah. So I think it's self-consistent in the sense that probably this remains consistent if you assign different parity properties to these quantities, as long as we remain in the magnetostatic limit. So it's only when, for instance, yeah. Yes. That's right. Yes. Yeah, it's accidental. It's useful to build some, but it's useful just to build some intuition, essentially.
More natural thing in higher regions would be a vortex heap, and that would obey the same.
The vorticity would still be, if then this doesn't have it, you shouldn't name a vorticity as a vector.
Yes.
So adding the a squared term would describe proliferation of the vortices and restoration of the symmetry.
That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't thought about that, honestly. Okay. So the very good. So. It's very useful to work in compressional limit because, as I said, we can build some intuition. But just by looking at the compressible limit, there are some questions that I think remain unanswered. The first one is, what is exactly the origin of this hydrophoton? And by that, I mean that essentially the way we proceeded was as follows. We started with effective theory for superfluid. We added vortex line in a non-local way with a non-local coupling. Then we integrated out the phonons, producing non-localities, additional localities. And from that point of view, it is actually a surprise that now we can read of all these, we can get rid of all these non-localities just by introducing a single vector field. Now, the second thing that, as I said, we would like to do is now include the compressional modes in this picture in a way that, in such a way that phonons now are coupled locally to the vortex lines. And finally, it would be nice to understand better what is the relation between, what is the origin of the logarithm that appeared in the dispersion relation for Kelvin waves. And as you see, it's really related to the question that Sergei asked earlier. So to try to answer all these questions, what I'm gonna do is shift gear and move on to a description of a superfluid, which is not based on a scalar field, but now it's based on a anti-symmetric rank 2 tensor, or if you want to be fancy, a 2-form. Now, the analog of d phi squared now is just the field strength squared of a mu associated with a mu nu. And instead of having an arbitrary function of x, now we have an arbitrary function of y. I should say that this duality, this precise form of duality works because we are in 3 plus 1. Now, the analogous of giving a time-dependent VEV to the scalar field is corresponds to giving a VEV to a mu nu now that only depends on spatial coordinates. But I should be a bit more precise about that because in the a mu nu language, the action is actually invariant under this gauge transformation. And so when I tell you that, so the VEV of a mu nu now becomes a gauge dependent concept. So when I tell you that phi equal t corresponds to this, I should tell you really in which gauge that I'm working with. And the gauge that I'm using is the analogous of the Coulomb gauge. So I'm setting di ai mu equals 0. Now, the exact correspondence between these two languages can be easily derived by calculating the stress energy tensor in the phi language and in the mu nu language, and then by imposing that the density, energy density, pressure, and for velocity in the two languages are equivalent. And if we do that, what we find is this relation between the a mu nu quantities and phi. And in particular, what this relation is telling us is that the four velocity of the superfluid, which in the phi language is just proportional to d mu phi, in this case, in the a mu nu language, is determined by the field strength associated with a mu nu, so this f mu. So, by the way, why do we want to do this? Why do we want to switch to a dual language? Well, there is, an easy way to understand why we need to do that. In the phi language, this vortex line that I'm adding as external sources are really a placeholder for defects in the phi language. And for instance, in electromagnetism, we know that to couple magnetic monopoles, which are defects, in a local way to the electromagnetic field, what we want to do is actually use the dual of a mu. And so something similar is really what's going on here. So now, the relativistic effective action that we're going to write down is going to consist of two pieces. We're going to have a 4D part of the action, which describes the dynamic of phonons in the bulk, which, as I said, is just this arbitrary function of y at lowest order in derivatives, plus a gauge fixing term, which enforces, for instance, a gauge condition like that. And then we're going to have a 2D part of the action that describes the dynamic of the vortex line. And at lowest order in derivative, there is an obvious interaction that we can write down between a mu nu and the vortex lines. This is just a generalization, if you want, of the interaction between a point particle and the electromagnetic field a mu. And then what else do we want to write here? Well, since we are trying to write down a relativistic action, a natural guess would be the Nambu-Goto term, right? Meaning the square root of the determinant of the induced metric on the worksheet. But in fact, that would be the correct guess if we were in vacuum. But this vortex line actually live in a medium. And because of that, there is something much more general that we can write down. So we can still define the usual induced metric on the worksheet. But now, because due to the fact that we have an extra structure, namely this four velocity, we can define a second induced metric, let's say starting from a metric in the bulk, an effective metric, for instance, g mu nu plus u mu u nu. Okay? And so what we end up with is really, if you want, a bimetric theory on the worksheet. And what our friends that work on bimetric theories of gravity tell us is that at lowest order in derivatives, the most general thing that we can write down is something like this. So we have a function of k minus 1 h. So this is just a 2 by 2 matrix. And now, since this is a 2 by 2 matrix, there are in principle two invariants that we could build starting from this product. Let's say, for instance, the determinant and the trace. But it turns out that the difference between induced metric and this one, because of the way I defined it, is just a rank 1 tensor, okay, this u mu u nu. And for this reason, there is, in fact, only one invariant that I can build out of this. And let me take the determinant. So if I take the determinant, what I end up with is an effective action of this form. So I have an arbitrary function of the ratio of these two determinants. And notice that this action now is clearly invariant, of course, under Lorentz. It's invariant now under full reparametrizations of the worksheet, so redefinitions of tau and sigma. And of course, it's also gauge invariant because I'm building it using y, and this term is gauge invariant up to the total derivative. Now, this is not actually the way in which we first derive this action, a little fun fact. Our initial approach was to use the fact that these Kelvin waves that I talked about before can be actually thought of as Goldstone bosons associated with the spacetime symmetries that are spontaneously broken by the vortex line. But now, because we are in a medium, the approach that we can take is that we can consider boost as explicitly broken by the medium. and just consider the spontaneously broken symmetry, the symmetries that are spontaneously broken by the vortex line. And those are just translations perpendicular to the line and rotations that are not around the vortex line. Whereas the unbroken quantities are, the unbroken generators are just time translations along the line and rotation around the vortex. So there is a very standard way of building effective theories for Goldstone bosons known as Gaussian construction. And Solomon, in fact, this afternoon will tell you everything you need to know about Gaussian construction for broken spacetime symmetries. But the idea is that we feed this pattern into the Gaussian construction, we turn the crank, and then we reintroduce the four velocity u mu, essentially as a spurion, in such a way as to obtain an action which is invariant under Lorentz, under gauge symmetries, and under full reparametrization of the worksheet. And if we do that, it turns out that there is only one way to do it, and the result that you get is precisely this. Okay. So now that we have this effective action, the first thing that we can do is go back and try to answer the first question that I posed, namely, what is the origin, where does the hydrophoton come from? To do that, to understand that, we can decompose a mu nu into the zero I component that I'm gonna call AI, and the IJ components that take a VEV in Coulomb gauge and whose fluctuations I'm calling B. So imposing the Coulomb gauge really is equivalent to setting the divergence of A to zero and the curl of B to zero. So we see that in this gauge, all the compressional modes are really described by B, and whereas the A turns out to be just an auxiliary field in the sense that in the action that I wrote down, A always appear with no time derivatives. And in this sense, it is really the hydrophoton, meaning also that the couplings between A and B, which describe sounds, are really the same couplings, at least to cubic order, that's what we checked, that Solomon and Alberto derived following a different approach, namely starting from the fluid side. Also, the coupling between A and vortex lines is exactly the same that we wrote down before in the incompressible limit. But now we see that gauge invariance is forcing upon us also a linear coupling between sound and vortex lines. And now from an effective theory point of view, we know what this will give rise to. This means that in the non-relativistic limit and the incompressible limit where I'm neglecting sound, vortex lines can interact only by exchange of this hydrophoton, thus generating this sort of Biot-Savart interaction between vortex lines. But as soon as we turn on sound, we can have interactions that are also mediated by exchange of sound, because now sound is massless, so it will, it's gapless, I should say, so it mediates long-range interactions. And in the non-relativistic limit, one can easily calculate this Feynman diagram and find that the correction to the effective action now will still scale like 1 over r, but it's going to be suppressed by 2 powers of V over CS. So in general, it's going to be a small correction because, as we said, these vortex lines move at speed that are much smaller than the speed of sound. But nevertheless, it's a correction that is there. Now, the second question that we had was, can we understand the origin of this logarithm in the dispersion relation for Kelvin waves? And to do that, we could start from our general action. But in fact, the simplest thing to do is to go back for a moment to the incompressible limit. And notice that when we send speed of sound and speed of light to infinity, of course, we get what we wrote down before. But in fact, we end up with one more term, which is just the length of the vortex line multiplied by some tension. And the role of this term proportional to the tension is the following. We can fix the tension by demanding that the energy per unit length of the vortex line is actually finite. So the energy per unit length receives two contributions, one from this 1 over r sort of interaction, which diverges logarithmically, and one from the this tension term. And so we see that we can cancel actually this this logarithmic divergence, the dependence on the width of the vortex line, by assuming that T is actually a parameter that runs with the scale, and by renormalizing T. And if we do that, now any calculation that we will do starting from this effective action with a running tension now is going to be free of these logarithmic divergences. In particular, if we now rederive the dispersion relation for Kelvin waves, we found that now they scale like the log of k over the scale mu at that we're interested in. Yes?
What happens if instead you consider a vortex loop, which will have a self-inductive kind of thing involving...
Yes, very good. So I'm, actually, this is what I'm going to...
There's like a size-dependent tension?
Yes, so let me move on. In fact, what I want to talk about now is precisely vortex ring. So let me see if that that answers your question.
Sorry, gamma doesn't run?
No, gamma gamma doesn't run. At least, yeah, gamma doesn't run. It's only the tension and any and other couplings that we may have in this arbitrary function here. Well, so all I'm saying here is that if I demand that the energy per unit length is finite, then I can absorb this A, if you want, into by renormalizing the tension. But to do that, I need to introduce a scale mu. And now when I introduce a scale mu, now, yeah, the tension will just depend on mu and run. Now, so, but this is, of course, so the spectrum of Kelvin waves is not the only thing, it's not the only place where these logarithms appear. Another place are precisely vortex rings. And now, unfortunately, William already showed these beautiful videos of dolphins.
I'm still kind of confused
yes.
by this point, though, because.
This one here?
Yeah. Previously, I mean, what is. Frequency is something physical.
Yes, yes, yes. You're right.
So I'm a bit previously if you had an explicit cutoff, I would be actually happier.
Yeah, yeah, no, but you're right. So in a sense, in fact, this log, this running is actually physical, meaning that if I have, okay, in the case of superfluids, the thickness is of superfluids is given, it's just atomic length. But in the case of ordinary fluids, I can actually consider vortices which has different thicknesses. And if I now have Kelvin waves that propagate around, let's say, two different vortex lines with different thicknesses, and these Kelvin waves have the same wavelength, then they will end up having different frequencies. So in a sense, this is really a physical running.
Sure, but I'm still confused what the final object is. Gamma doesn't run, then what do you mean precisely by? I mean, I understand that you could, at some level, just forget about it and say I'm working at k's of order mu, but.
Yes.
But so, it just.
Are you just saying you put mu equal to whatever the thickness is?
Yeah.
Whatever the thickness.
Yeah, yeah, you can set that.
Right, but that was before.
Yeah. Yeah. That was what he's going to say. Just
okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm happy with that, but I'm just trying to understand what was the advantage of putting mu in.
Well, so the advantage is that in general, okay, this is a very, very simple example, but in general, when we do other calculations, such as, for instance, emission of phonons from vortex rings that oscillate or from vortex lines that rotate around each other, there might be instances in which it's more convenient to choose mu to choose a different value of mu in such a way to get so that the calculation becomes easier. But okay, maybe we can discuss more later. So what I was saying is that, yes, this morning William already showed these beautiful videos with dolphins playing with vortex rings. So there isn't much that I can add to that, except for the fact that I want to point out that belugas can also play with vortex rings. And the crucial difference is that they use their mouth to produce them rather than their blowhole. But from our point of view, this is just a UV detail. And so our low energy effective theory does not depend on that. All right, so very good. So how can we use our effective action to describe vortex rings? Well, the simplest thing that we can do is consider an approximation where the size of the vortex ring is very small, and I can break the x of t and sigma into two pieces, one that essentially describes the position of the center of mass at a given time, and one that describes how, if you want, the shape of the vortex line around the center of mass. And if we plug this expression into our action and integrate over sigma, what we end up with is an effective, it's a simple Lagrangian for that describes the behavior of vortex rings. And again, we see that we have a kinetic term with only one time derivative. And now if we vary this action with respect to n, which is the normal vector to the vortex ring, x naught, which is the position of the center of mass, and r, the radius of the vortex ring, what we find is that, we find these three equations. So first of all, this equation tells us that the velocity of a vortex ring is always aligned, is always perpendicular to the vortex ring. So this means that the normal vector essentially doesn't change direction over time, which means that we can take it outside the derivative here. And this equation now tells us that the radius of a vortex ring doesn't change either over time. And finally, this equation, what it's telling us is that the velocity of the vortex ring is completely determined by its radius. Now, part of the reason why we're interested in vortex rings, and here we're entering the more speculative part of the talk, is that eventually we'd be interested in trying to make some progress in understanding rotons in helium 4. And so rotons, so the spectrum of elementary excitations in superfluids looks like this. And the linear part of the spectrum is what we usually associate with phonons. But there is also a dip here in this dispersion relation. And excitations around this this minimum is what are known as rotons. Now notice that this minimum is really located at momenta that are of order of the inverse interatomic separation in helium. So it's something that I cannot describe in my effective theory I cannot add easily to my effective theory for phonons, but what one would like to do, or what we would like to do, is try to see whether we can add them as external sources that now cannot be destroyed or created in our effective theory. And the reason why we hope that understanding better vortex rings will lead to progress in that direction is that there is this conjecture that was first put forward by Feynman that rotons are nothing but microscopic vortex rings. And by making this assumption, Feynman was in fact able to derive the qualitative features of the spectrum. And so the hope would be that if we understand better how vortex rings couple to sound, then we might also get a handle on how rotons couple to sound within an effective theory.
Isn't that scale sort of contradicts this hypothesis, scale 1 over A?
Yes, meaning that
they cannot be essentially rings, because you cannot create something collective out of essentially empty space.
Well, no, I mean here I'm just setting the scale, but maybe okay. Let me elaborate more. A bit on what I mean by this. So the effective action that I wrote before, okay, this effective Lagrangian, can also be derived, again, another fun fact, using the, again, the Cosette construction, and starting from the pattern of symmetry breaking that is associated now, instead of with a line, with the vortex ring. And the effective action that you get is going to contain less information than this action, meaning we won't be able to derive the velocity in terms of its radius, so the velocity will just be an initial condition. But it's something that is valid at distances much larger than the size of the vortex ring. So the hope would be that, let's say, using the Cosette construction, we can in fact write down an effective action for rotons, even though now we are in a regime where the picture of rotons as microscopic vortex ring starts breaking down. But hopefully, I mean, one of the possibilities is that the pattern of symmetry breaking still remains the same, and so we can still, and so we can use that fact. Okay, so now that we have derived this effective action, this relativistic effective action, well, what do we want to do with it? Well, what we're planning to do in the future is really exploit now the analogy that becomes apparent when you use this two-form language between the motion of the non-relativistic motion of point particles in gravitational fields and the motion of vortex lines in superfluids. So in this language, the analog of the metric and its perturbations is really the two form and its perturbations. And instead of having just word lines describing the particles, we're gonna have word sheets describing the vortex lines. But it's still true that when these objects, of course, when binaries, when objects move around each other, they emit gravitational waves. And similarly, we have, when two vortices, let's say with the circulation in the same direction, move around each other, they're going to produce some sound. And so the hope is that we can, in fact, reuse most of the techniques that were developed to describe motion of non-relativistic objects in gravitational fields and apply them to this context. In fact, these techniques were really developed by Ira and Walter that are here in the audience. Now, there is just one crucial difference between these two pictures, which is that in this case, of course, the background value for the metric is just Minkowski. So we have a theory that is Lorentz invariant. Whereas in this case, we have a background that is actually not Lorentz invariant. And so that is an extra layer of complication.
So does a single vortex or a vortex ring with Kelvin waves never emit sound?
No, actually, a vortex ring, say, with Kelvin waves actually emit sound. And in fact, we have two graduate students at Columbia. They actually calculated the power emitted by a single vortex ring with a Kelvin wave. But the calculation is, it's very, very complicated. You need to go to these toroidal coordinates, and it's quite non-trivial. So the hope is that using effective theory techniques, you can effectively speed up these kind of calculations and make them more efficient. Now, I should say that this kind of emission of sound from, for instance, two vortex lines orbiting each other is fairly well understood now. When it comes to numerical simulations, this is a simulation that the result of a simulation that Carlo just gave me today, and the hope would be now that we can go beyond having a numerical understanding. For instance, this simulation is based on the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. And the hope is that we can go beyond this just numerical understanding of the Gross-Pitayevsky equation and now start having some analytical control over the emission of sound from vortex lines. And just very quickly, how would one go about you know, setting up an effective theory that allows you to do calculations efficiently? So what we want to do is have an effective theory that really takes advantage of the fact that these vortices are moving slowly in the superfluid. And so an effective theory that has an explicit power counting in powers of velocity over CS. This is precisely what Walter and Ira were able to derive in the case of GR. And this is what we would like to have also in the case of superfluids. So if for simplicity, let me just set the speed of sound to be of order of, let me just consider a relativistic superfluid, just so we have one less speed to deal with. And the way one would go about deriving an effective action with explicit velocity power counting is by decomposing the, let's say we're going to work in Coulomb gauge. So one can decompose the phonon field now into two parts, a potential and a radiation part. And these two parts are such that schematically, the potential part is responsible for potential interaction between vortex lines. And so it's not on shell. And it's so spatial derivatives acting on the potential part will scale like 1 over r, where say r is the typical distance between the vortex lines, whereas time derivatives will scale like v over r. So this is a very off-shell phonon.
Because you also have this Kelvin wave frequency, right? So that's another scale.
Yes, that's right. But if you actually
in other words, the radiation mode that you have here seems to be related to the orbital frequency of these strings around each other.
Yes, that's right.
But the same as Jared was saying, the single string by itself.
Yeah, that's right. But so for in the case of the vortex lines, you can actually derive, so you can use the fact that for a superfluid, we know how the circulation can be expressed in terms of the thickness and the speed of sound in the superfluid. And so you can show that effectively the relation between the relation between Kelvin wave, sorry, the frequency of Kelvin waves and their wavelength is precisely such that you have this mismatch 1 over r. So they scale like 1 over r. When the wavelength scale like 1 over r, the frequency scales like v over r now. Now, the other part of the phonon field is just what we call the radiation part. Which is the part that makes it to infinity when we have sound that is emitted. And in this case, both derivatives, spatial and time derivatives, acting on the radiation part will scale like V over R. And to get an effective action that has explicit power counting, velocity power counting, what we want to do is start with the action that I wrote down before and integrate out the potential modes and integrate out the hydrophoton. And when we do that, we end up with an effective action that only involves radiation modes. And now the power counting in velocity becomes explicit because any kind of derivative that acts on the radiation modes is just has the same weight in a sense. And so this kind of procedure, what it will really give you is if you want an effective theory implementation of a sort of post-Newtonian expansion for that applies to vortex lines. And the hope is that you know this formalism can in fact be used to, as I said before, gain some analytic understanding of the emission of phonons from vortex lines and more complicated vortex configurations. So thanks for your attention.